This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Yesterday, Governor Peter Shumlin called a hasty press conference to announce the news that a Rutland area man who'd been traveling in Sierra Leone and Guinea had returned to Vermont and was in voluntary quarantine in an undisclosed location.
We have been following closely his plans to return to the United States. We've obviously cooperated with both our federal and New York State partners. And when he was cleared for travel back to the United States because he had no symptoms, we ensured that we had both Vermont law enforcement and health department folks on the ground at JFK to ensure that he had a safe return to Vermont.
The man is not being identified, but he is being put up by the state and monitored by the health department. He apparently did not know that he would be met at the airport by Vermont authorities. And while the man has voluntarily agreed to be quarantined for 21 days, Governor Shumlin said at the press conference that he was ready to act with more firm authority to keep the man isolated if that became necessary. Joining me now are two state officials at the center of this story, Acting Health Commissioner Tracy Dolan and State Epidemiologist Patsy Kelso. Thank you both for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Yep. We're happy to be here.
Is there any news that has come out since the press conference that we should be aware of, Tracy Dolan?
No, I think the press conference, the information provided by the governor and myself and Dr. Kelso was pretty comprehensive.
It has come out since then that this man is from the Rutland area, and some more details about the fact that he's being put up by the state in, it looks like, a house right now. Are you hoping that this man will not be identified during this entire period? Because it seems like there's a push to try to get facts on who he is.
I think it's important that people understand that their privacy can be respected in this kind of situation. And so I think if any of us were in a similar type of situation, we'd want our privacy respected. And from perspective of the Department of Health, it's something we really try to maintain around issues of health.
Patsy Kelso, quarantining a healthy person, how does that actually align with medical best practices?
It's a public health practice that we don't use very often, but it's something that's been around for decades, actually, in the U.S. and is used infrequently, but is used by states for things like infectious tuberculosis. And we have used it in Vermont in the past for cases of infectious TB. Again, it's not something we use very often, but the idea is you keep people who are infectious or potentially infectious away from the general community to prevent the spread and protect the broader public health.
In other states where there have been issues similar to this and people have been put in quarantine who have come in contact with people who had Ebola, there have been some criticisms of state officials who have been doing similar things to what Vermont is doing, quarantining healthy people who are exhibiting no symptoms. And public health officials have been saying that doesn't align with public health policy. That's not actually scientifically sound. It seems like a political decision. Patsy Kelso, how do you respond to that?
There are guidelines from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and we follow those guidelines, and then we take all the available information and, along with the guidelines, interpret the information we have and figure out what's the best thing to implement for the situation that we have.
Commissioner Dolan, is this a political response rather than a medically sound response, quarantining this man?
I would say this is a public health response. We are absolutely looking at the CDC guidelines and but of course, in every state, I actually spoke to some state officials this morning in this part of the country, and we really are all trying to figure it out. It's evolving, so we don't have a really great sort of set list from which to choose here. So it's evolving, but we're absolutely having to do this case by case. Every case is slightly different.
So you're confident that this is the right response for this particular case, to keep this man in quarantine for the time period in which he could become symptomatic?
This is the right response. There is no perfect decision in this situation, again, because we don't have a great history of responding to this kind of issue in the United States. But I think this is the best response that we can have right now. And I have grappled, and we all have. It's a very serious thing to place or to ask somebody to go into quarantine. And so we've certainly thought long and hard about it, and we do feel like this is the best response at this time.
Listening to Governor Shumlin's words about voluntary versus involuntary commitment or observation in quarantine, this man has voluntarily agreed to go into quarantine, but it seems voluntary in so much as the man has agreed to it. but it seems involuntary in the sense that he is, by all accounts, going to be in quarantine for the time period that he could become symptomatic, whether he wants to be or not. So is it only voluntary because he has said, okay?
It's voluntary in that he has said, okay, but we're also really trying to manage it as it goes. If things were to change, we would have to reassess. We'd have to look at the factors on the ground, the individual's behavior, what we know, any new guidance coming out from CDC. So it's voluntary in that he has agreed to it. And I really do want to point out that we are so pleased that we have a cooperative individual here. This individual is also very concerned about the epidemic and really does believe that the state should be taking things seriously. And we're pleased that he has that understanding and that sense of cooperation.
When you say things could change and you'll monitor the situation, do you mean there is a circumstance under which he could be not quarantined?
I think right now our plan is 21 days of quarantine, and that's probably how it will move forward. But our plan is 21 days, and there's nothing right now that tells us that we will deviate from that plan.
Patsy Kelso, were you involved in the decision to meet this man at JFK, and were public health officials involved in deciding how to meet him when he got off the airplane?
Yes, public health officials were involved. Lots of folks were involved, but it was certainly a decision based on public health and the best guidance that we have available about public health actions.
Can you tell us a little bit more about what kind of protocols were involved in getting this man from the airplane to Vermont? Did he travel in a police car? Were officials wearing protective gear? What kind of situation was it?
He traveled in a car with a representative from the Vermont Department of Health. And because he is not and was not showing any signs or symptoms of Ebola virus disease, no personal protective equipment was indicated or was worn. So it was just the individuals all riding in a car together.
I'm talking right now with Patsy Kelso, the state epidemiologist, and Tracy Dolan, the acting health commissioner, and we're getting more details on the evolving situation that we heard about yesterday with a man who has returned from West Africa to Vermont and is currently in voluntary quarantine in the Rutland area. Commissioner Dolan, will this be protocol for other Vermonters who travel from West Africa that they will enter quarantine when arriving in the country?
Because we anticipate that we will actually get very few travelers coming from West Africa here into Vermont, we really want to take it on a case-by-case basis. So we are not setting out a written policy that absolutely categorizes people. We will look at the best CDC guidance and, again, take factors into account unique to each individual.
Although there is an anticipation that there will be healthcare workers, we know of several who are departing shortly for the area. Patsy Kelso?
And as Commissioner Dolan referenced, the CDC guidance has us look at the types of exposures that individuals may have had while they were in Africa. So if they were providing direct health care to individuals who are sick with Ebola, or if they were wearing personal protective equipment, the type of contact they had with people who may have been sick, those kinds of things. And so we would interview the individual and get all that epidemiologic information, and then that helps us make decisions about what kind of monitoring or follow-up would be indicated.
So even if a healthcare worker was working with Ebola patients, it's not decided at this point whether those healthcare workers would be quarantined when they return.
That's correct. It depends on other factors like what kind of personal protective equipment they were wearing and whether they had any known breaches in that personal protective equipment or any known exposures to, you know, blood or body fluids from a case.
So, Commissioner Dolan, are there things about this case that the public is not privy to about what this man was possibly exposed to that would indicate that he should be quarantined?
I think we're not certain of all aspects of his activity while in West Africa, in part because he wasn't with an organization that we're familiar with. And those organizations really would have provided him with the kind of knowledge he would need to know in terms of which communities might be affected, which individuals he was in contact with who might have been infected. And because we're not aware of all of those details, we thought it would be prudent to take this very cautious approach. And we recognize it's very cautious, but we also think it's the right approach.
How cooperative is he being about detailing where he went and who he was in contact with?
both according to our sources who have interviewed him and according to the CDC, who also interviewed him at JFK, because that's part of the protocol as people come back. He's been very open and he's been forthcoming in the interviews. And we really do think we are lucky to have a really cooperative person who understands the severity of the issue and is willing to cooperate with the best public health measures.
Patsy Kelso, we heard yesterday in the press conference that four health department workers are going to be monitoring this gentleman in teams of two. How were they trained and selected for this task? I understand they volunteered.
Yeah, these are public health nurses, and there's no specific training for the work that they'll be doing. As public health nurses, they routinely interview cases who have infectious diseases, talk to patients, collect health information, assess how folks are doing, that kind of thing. And that's much like what they'll be doing with this individual. So, you know, we've given them guidance about this particular disease and signs and symptoms that they should be asking about. But beyond that, they're doing work much like they would do for any other infectious disease and just talking to an individual who, you know, might be infected.
One of the questions that I heard from some listeners after the press conference was, why aren't these workers wearing protective gear when they're monitoring and taking the temperature of this gentleman? Can you explain a little bit more about the disease and why you feel that that's not necessary?
Yeah, Ebola is only spread by people who are symptomatic. And as we've said, this individual has no signs or symptoms of Ebola. He may have had exposure, and that's why he's under quarantine and being monitored in case he develops symptoms. But while he's asymptomatic and has no fever, there's no indication that he's infectious at all. And so that's why there's no requirement for any kind of personal protective equipment, you know, masks, nothing is indicated. We are, you know, checking to make sure he's feeling well before we're visiting, because obviously he might develop symptoms in between visits. But other than that, there's no indication that any kind of protection is warranted. And in addition to that, we know that people with Ebola are not very infectious in the first days of illness. And that's why you may have heard that when someone does have Ebola, in the first couple days of illness, their blood test can be negative for the virus. And that's because they just don't have a lot of virus in the blood during the first few days. It's in the later stages of illness when they have lots of vomiting or diarrhea or other symptoms that they do have lots of virus and they can be very infectious. And so, you know, in those, even in the early stages when someone does come down with illness, we don't think that they're all that infectious. But it still does take contact with blood or body fluids to become infected.
Given that the healthcare workers who are in very close contact with this man are not wearing protective gear because he's asymptomatic, so he cannot transmit any disease to anyone else. Commissioner Dolan, again, going back to this quarantine, why is that necessary, given that this gentleman is asymptomatic and cannot transmit the disease until he is symptomatic? And as Patsy Kelso was telling us, really in those very early stages, there's the least amount of risk.
Because
it seems like a mixed signal.
Sure. The monitoring piece is really important. So as we're monitoring his health, that's really the key piece. And so having him in voluntary quarantine really makes it much easier to monitor. Were he not in that situation, and if we didn't have those kind of monitoring protocols, we may not be able to track whether or not he was developing fever or other symptoms. So it really is also for his health protection, so that we can move very quickly in the early stages, because that is the best likelihood for success if we're able to address it early, and also for the protection of the public. And so it allows us better monitoring access.
Patsy Kelso, can you just delineate what the step-by-step plan would be should he develop symptoms? Where does he go? How does he get transported? Who would be doing that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've thought about that a lot, because that's really important in the unlikely event that that does happen. So we would have healthcare providers from the local healthcare facility. They've agreed that they would go.
Is that Rutland Regional?
Rutland Regional Medical Center would go to assess him where he's being quarantined, to see if, in fact, you know, we think that he's got symptoms that could be Ebola virus disease, or maybe it's something else, which is also quite possible. And then if they think it's indeed suspicious for Ebola virus disease, he would be transported to Fletcher Allen Healthcare, where they are well prepared to take care of a patient with Ebola virus disease.
Commissioner Dolan, we heard from Fletcher Allen doctors last week on VPR that they're considering it not an if, but a when they get a case of a patient who possibly has Ebola or who's been exposed to Ebola. How much planning and preparation has the health department and have hospitals done to address that situation should it come?
So the health department and healthcare facilities, EMS, and other partners around the state have been planning for weeks. Internally at the health department, we opened our health operations center, which allows us for better coordination of preparation. And so I feel like they've been doing a lot of preparation, which is great. And because in part we're a small state, we've been able to have really great discussions between the smaller hospitals and our larger hospital, Fletcher Allen. And we've had great cooperation, great leadership from Fletcher Allen as well. So I think we're as prepared as we can be. And of course, the preparations and the practicing for the infection control continues.
Tracy Dolan is the acting health commissioner. Patsy Kelso is the state epidemiologist. Thank you both for being here and talking a little bit with me today. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
We've been learning about the state's response to information that a Vermont man had traveled in Ebola-affected areas of West Africa and is now under voluntary quarantine. You can follow VPR's ongoing coverage of this story online at vpr.net. Coming up, we're going to look at the school consolidation issue by honing in on one supervisory union whose communities are considering reducing the number of schools, and rearranging where and how their children go to school. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Education Secretary Rebecca Holcomb has called on Vermont school districts to begin a community dialogue to ensure that all students have a wide range of educational opportunities. One of the unresolved issues of the recent legislative session was a bill that called on many of Vermont's smaller school districts to consolidate over the next 4 years. A third of all Vermont school districts have fewer than 100 students. Holcomb says it's inevitable that some of the schools in these tiny districts are going to need to close.
Some of these very small towns, they can have conversations till the end of time. And at the end of the day, some of them, their schools will close because they do not have the resources internally in their communities to actually build a sustainable future. As our population in the state ages, that will only be more the case.
Some communities are already looking at their population of students and the educational offerings they want to provide and are thinking about how consolidation might work. Questions about what's best for students, what actually curbs costs, and whether consolidation represents a loss of total local control all swirl around in these conversations, making it difficult to think about what it means on the small scale to actually consider this kind of plan. So today we're going to zero in on one supervisory union that's taking steps towards consolidation. Just steps at this point, no decisions, but they're thinking about how it might work nonetheless. Alice Worth is superintendent of the Windsor Central Supervisory Union. Greg Green is chair of the Pomfret Elementary School Board, which is in that union, and he's a member of the Joint Elementary Study Committee. Greg, Alice, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you for having us today.
Thank you so much, Jane.
Alice Worth, let's go over the situation you're dealing with in your communities right now. The towns of Pomfret, Bridgewater, and Woodstock are thinking about merging schools. There's a union high school and middle school that all the older students go to right now, but there are three separate elementary schools, one in each town. What are the situations in those towns that would lead you to think about consolidation in the first place?
Oh, that's a great question. Jane, I thought it was interesting that you started the discussion with Rebecca's comment on schools, a third of the schools having 100 students. We actually have schools that are hovering closer to 50 in each of the schools. And one of the schools in this study presently has 37 students in K-6. So the declining enrollment is really showing in these little schools. The issues that are the predominant issues for us are all framed around presenting opportunities for learning that really meet the fulfilling the aspirations of kids. And I'm really proud of our boards because they have been looking at the consolidation pretty much primarily from a standpoint of how do we improve educational opportunities for our kids. You noted that, you know, these are individual school districts and they do share in common a union middle school and high school. And we do operate as a supervisory union around four core principles that we use as a filter for all of our decision making. And two of those are equity and cohesiveness. So I guess, you know, generally speaking, and to frame this conversation, that's the real driver. We've tried a lot of methods to reduce costs and meet the needs of kids, including multi-age classrooms and, you know, improvising around some of our related arts needs in physical education and wellness and these kinds of things. But at the end of the day, it's really clear that we're just prolonging a very difficult and emotional decision. And we found that stepping back and looking at it purely from that educational lens has been helpful.
Well, so when you're looking at schools that may have fewer than 50 students, that does affect the educational opportunities they have because you can't have the staffing for, you know, certain art classes or more language classes. Is that the kind of thing that you're looking at when you talk about educational opportunities?
Yes, exactly. And coupled with that, of course, is the mindfulness around costs. You know, in these schools, we have a differential. Now, the schools that are in the study have a differential of about $3,000 per student for ed spending, equalized student spending. But throughout the supervisory union, that differential is even wider. It's like a $5,000 per pupil difference just among these small schools. So, you know, that in itself begs the question around the equity piece, which, again, I can't underscore, you know, firmly enough, is a really important part of our work.
Greg Green, you are chair of the Pomfret Elementary School Board in addition to being a member of the study committee. Can you get us even zeroed in more narrowly on Pomfret's situation? So why did Pomfret want to look at consolidation?
We were charged at last year's town meeting with really looking at the options. We're very fortunate in the community of Pomfret to have an extremely supportive community who's very involved in our school. I think it's fair to say that we have an outstanding elementary school in the town of Pomfret. However, the costs are definitely of a concern. And the question of combining some classes, and over the years we have reduced our language program, our arts program, and we're concerned about those opportunities for the kids. Operating a public school in Vermont these days is a real balancing act, and we felt that it was the time to really investigate our options so that the taxpayers of Pomfret could make an educated decision as to what we really want to do with our school.
Do school facilities come into question? I mean, you mentioned that Pomfret has what you say is an excellent school, and I think most places probably think of their community schools as excellent. But do facilities come into play when you think about the issue of consolidation and looking at having to put a new roof on a school, or how to keep the lights on, or how to keep it heated?
They certainly do, and one of the schools in this study is facing some pretty significant costs, and with a small population, so they would require some significant capital costs. So that is definitely one consideration in their decision to participate, definitely.
So the plan that you have outlined so far goes like this. All K through 4 students in the district would go to Woodstock, while all 5th and 6th graders would go to the Pomfret School, and the Bridgewater School would close. How did you come up with that plan?
It was a unanimous decision after a lot of work and a lot of options. The committee looked at 11 or 12 different combinations and permutations of schools. Everything from keeping the youngest kids in their town school for and moving the older kids to another location to merging all kids into one school. The as Alice mentioned, we approach this with really how do we increase and improve the educational opportunities for all of the students of all three of these towns? And with the capacity of the Woodstock Elementary School and the fact that the Pomfret School is 2.5 miles from the Woodstock School and has a very, very nice campus with playing fields, streams, hiking trails, 30 acres. The committee felt that there were real opportunities to accelerate the 5th and 6th grade students by using the Pomfret School as a campus of what we're going to call the Joint District School.
We're looking today at how school and school district consolidation might work in one set of towns in Vermont. Listeners, if you have a question for the superintendent or for one of the members of the committee who's looking into this issue in his town, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. We'd love to know if what you're hearing resonates with you. What does it look like in your town, and do you see advantages or disadvantages to closing some schools, consolidating schools? How do you see an educational benefit or detriment to the students that you care about? You can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or, again, call 1-800-639-2211. We got a note from Scott who says school consolidation is probably not a good idea, but district consolidation is really critical right now. But Cindy says, I think we're doing a disservice to our kids if schools are not consolidated. We need to let go of the mindset of neighborhood schools, fewer class offerings, poorly appointed science labs, and less competition. Our kids need to be challenged and exposed to not just a greater academic choice, but also to greater social choices if they are to be prepared for a world stage. This is not possible with the current structure of our school system. Alice Worth, we're going to talk a little bit now about the benefits and the potential downsides of this plan that Greg Green just outlined. So what do you see as the benefits?
Well, you know, I'd like to expand a little on Greg's comment in terms of the promoting this one particular design, and it goes to the benefit piece. So the Pomfret campus is you know, we just felt it was really conducive to ratcheting up our attention around science, math, and technology, and engineering, actually. There's a just a wonderful observatory that's on the campus that's used within the Pomfret Science Program, and they're always very welcoming to others to come. But we saw that as a potential catalyst to really develop a deeper science opportunity for kids. The Woodstock Elementary School recently went through a major renovation of their playground space, and it's a beautiful space, perhaps more conducive to younger children. So again, looking at that school quality piece, looking at those opportunities for kids, we see that as a huge advantage. The other thing that's mentioned by one of your writers is we've had quite a lot of discussion around what it means to be the only sixth grade boy in a small school or the only third grade girl in a small school that may not have social and or academic peers. We even have, consolidated our efforts a little to the point of tuitioning one child from one of our schools to another schools because the condition in the one homeschool really wasn't the right and ripe condition for that child. But, you know, we've tried to look at this whole thing as in its entirety. And as Greg said, the one school with the aging building that's going to take lots of capital money, you know, improvements. The fact that we have these small schools where we have kids without peers, academic and social peers, the limited academic and enrichment programs that we can offer. We've had discussions about after-school programming, preschool programming now with the state mandate, and those things cannot be done. We know that in our small schools. We are having trouble meeting the minimum standards. And Jane, I don't know if your listeners are familiar with two what I think are incredibly powerful documents in the state that have been developed by educational leaders that really can be used to help guide these discussions and maybe take some of the emotional sting, you know, out of the decision making. And one of those, of course, is the school quality standards that were recently reauthorized and really look more at qualitative issues in schooling than quantitative issues. And the other is a Vermont Superintendent's Education Quality Framework, which can be found on the VSA website, that really takes a look at what are the skills, knowledge, and dispositions kids need in the 21st century to realize their potential. So we keep trying to bring it back to that framework because we know it is a very emotionally charged conversation.
Let's go to the calls. Doug is calling in from one of the towns we're talking about here today, Pomfret. Hi, Doug. Nice to have you on the air. Go right ahead.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to speak in support of the idea of consolidation, especially in our district. I'm an older parent. We had four kids that went through the Pomfret schools starting in 82 when they were one-room schools. And we were there when we built the new school. One of my kids helped Howard Dean dig the first shovelful of dirt there. So I just wanted to also point out that this whole question of consolidation statewide is going to really involve more transportation for people going longer distances, as we talked about here in the Woodstock area, which are shorter. One thing is a known fact is that school buses are way safer to ride in for children than personal cars by a great margin. So people need to keep that in mind when they're worried about, oh, I have to drive over a mountain to get to the school my kid's in now. School buses are pretty underutilized, so people are going to need to realize that.
Doug, thanks for your call. I appreciate that. You know, while we're talking about busing, we got a note from Steve who wrote in to say, I don't agree that it's somehow better for kids to spend 2 hours or more a day riding around on a school bus than it is for them to go to a small nearby school. So that doesn't address the sort of maintenance costs that Doug was talking about. But Greg Green, could you address that issue of whether or not this is going to cause kids to have to spend more time getting to school, more time on buses?
We definitely were very concerned about the transportation issues, the time that students would be spending on a bus. The transportation time for the kids from Pomfret to Woodstock, as I mentioned, it's 2.5 miles between the two campuses. So that's not a significant amount of time. The Bridgewater School is 6.5 miles from the Woodstock campus. And the routing of the buses may reduce the increase of time. Will some kids spend more time on the bus? Yes. But we don't feel that it's a very large amount of time. We're looking at, you know, 10 to 15 minutes, worst case scenario
time
for most people. Yep.
We're looking today at school consolidation. We're talking with Alice Wirth, who's superintendent of the Windsor Central Supervisory Union, and Greg Green, who's the chair of the Pomfret Elementary School Board. He's a member of the Joint Elementary Study Committee that's looking at how it might work to consolidate three elementary schools in the region into two. And we're looking at this as sort of a micro look at how this issue could work in other Vermont towns. So we're interested in hearing from listeners who are thinking about this in their own communities or listening to what they're hearing and thinking about how it could apply to where they live. If you have a question or you want to share your thoughts, you can post them on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or call 1-800-639-2211. More coming right up here on Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking school consolidation with Alice Wirth, who's superintendent of the Windsor Central Supervisory Union, and Greg Green, chair of the Pomfret Elementary School Board and a member of the Joint Elementary Study Committee that's investigating how this might work. Again, if you have a question about school consolidation or want to make a point about how it might be beneficial or detrimental in your own community, give us your perspective. What might this look like for your kids, your town, your schools? Call 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Greg Green, can you explain a little bit about what might change in addition to the schools going from three schools to two? What about the governance, the school boards and school principals? Can you just tease that out, how that might work? Because we're looking at school consolidation and district consolidation in the same plan in this case.
Yeah, I'll do my best. This proposal uses a structure called a joint district school. And that would be a school that is operated by multiple boards. So there would be representation from each of the member towns on the joint board that would operate, in this particular case, one school with two campuses. So the individual town boards would still exist at a very minimal level. Basically, their responsibilities would be to approve the budget annually. But the work of the board operating the joint district school, we essentially would go from three individual elementary school boards to one operating school board.
So there's one operating school board, but each town has its own board that also gets involved. But basically, the governance for the school is one board that has representatives from all three towns. Am I getting that right?
Correct.
Okay.
I'll leave it at yes, you are correct.
And you go from three principals to one and a half?
In this proposal, we have a one and a half administration team. So there would be a principal and most likely a vice principal type of arrangement to supervise the two campuses.
Let's go to Michael, who's calling in from Winooski. Hi, Michael. Go ahead. Your thoughts.
Hi. I have a question that follows up a little bit regarding what you just were commenting about. When the districts join together, teachers from different districts will have different salaries. How are you going to address the issue of one district having a higher payment structure or a lower payment structure? How is that going to be resolved? Are some teachers going to take a loss in pay, or are other teachers just going to get an automatic increase in pay?
Michael, thanks for the question. Alice Wirth, Superintendent Wirth, can you address that?
Yeah, that's a really good question and a very difficult one. We are actually in the process right now of working at negotiating a joint contract with our hopes of having a merger of our diverse salary schedules into one. We actually find that within our district, we compete against each other unwittingly for teachers, and because we have such a range between the different salary grids. So that's an important goal for us. You know, whether we will achieve that in this negotiations or not is yet to be seen. We have used a methodology to bring those grids together that benefits the teachers in terms of rising them up as opposed to lowering them down to achieve the equity. So we think we've thought that through quite well, and we're moving forward in that regard. We've also studied the extent to which, because this has been a concern in our communities, the extent to which we may have to RIF teachers, reduce the teaching force. And our projections are that through a natural attrition and, you know, retirements and whatnot that we're anticipating, that will not be a problem for us.
You mean you won't but you will have to reduce the number of teachers.
We will be reducing the teachers, but we will not be needing to RIF currently employed teachers as we move towards this consolidation.
So how would it work to reduce the numbers? Are you talking about voluntary retirement, for example?
Well, we have some pretty much scheduled retirements. You know, we have within our master agreement, teachers need to let us know by a certain timeline. And we also just, you know, in anticipation of this is what our projections are.
Greg Green, what are the projected cost savings from this plan?
I'm going to actually defer to Alice, who's flipping through the presentation yeah. for the grand total figure.
I mean, there are cost savings associated. You mentioned, you both mentioned at the beginning of this discussion that the primary focus was on delivering better education to the students. But there is also this question of efficiency and cost savings and looking at the tax burden on Vermonters. And you do find some cost savings in this plan that you are anticipating.
We do.
Superintendent Wirth, have I given you enough time?
Yeah, you did great, Jane. You know, we do. So it's a little complex, but in the first year, we're realizing a savings of about $500,000. What's been kind of tricky is to address this from the standpoint of the so what about the tax rate savings in regards to that. And that is, you know, there's a huge differential from 1 to 16 cents depending on the school. But that's just in year one because, as Greg referenced, you know, in the long haul, we have anticipated capital needs in one building in particular and another building perhaps that also will show, you know, will impact the savings over the long haul. So, you know, yeah, so we feel pretty comfortable that it's a win-win. The design is a win-win, both from the financial side and the school quality side. Yep. So, and those savings, Jane, are in regards to the things that that Greg referenced: the reduction of teachers, the administrative savings, and some facilities savings, and also some anticipated, actually reasonably calculated, excess spending penalty savings. Because our schools, one of them, Pomfret, has already reached gone beyond that threshold, and the others are fast approaching. And that's been another incredibly critical factor for us to consider.
Let's go to John, who's calling in from Stratford. Hi, John. Go right ahead.
Hi, Jane. Thanks. What a great program. This is precisely the way we should consider school consolidation. Coming from the bottom up, doing the work for the particular situation the communities are in. This is the way we should go, rather than H-80-83, which was a state-mandated, one-size-fits-all type of situation. If it's this to be good for our children, each of our communities are unique, have unique situations. You get the buy-in from the communities, from the administrators, from the teachers, from the parents, and you make it work. This is the way to go. Congratulations,
John,
to all them.
Thank you for your comments. Appreciate that. And let's go quickly here to Peter Peltz, who's vice chair of the House Education Committee. Representative Peltz, go right ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. We're all concerned about loss of local control, and I have an idea to pose to Alice and Greg about that. If you had an annual budget meeting that was done in an open meeting format, such as we do in small towns and whatnot, where the budget could be discussed and possibly amended by all the participating electorate, would from your standpoint, would that ease the concern about a loss of local control?
Greg Green, let's put that to you.
Our budget planning sessions are open to all of the Pomfret community and as well as the staff of our school. We actively seek input on the formation of the budget already. As you know, education funding is extremely complex, and unless you've spent some time flowing through the difficult worksheets, it can be very, very challenging. So I guess I feel that to a certain extent we already are including our community in the planning process, and I don't know that it would really make things much easier.
Well, before we let you go, let's talk just briefly about that community response. We've gotten a couple notes from people who are worried about, you know, the community feel to this. Abby says schools are community centers for our small communities, and to lose them would not only affect those children, but all members of the community. The approval process for this plan, that is just a plan at this point, just a proposal, is you have to take this to the school boards. Then if the boards approve it, you have to take it to the towns. But Greg Green, are you hearing from some townspeople about what they think of the plan so far?
Yeah, we held three community forums in the last month in each of the towns, and they were very, very interesting and eye-opening for all the members of the committee in terms of what the different towns were thinking and feeling. The reactions were very different in the towns, but I think overall the message that the committee got was we need to prove to the towns that we will increase the educational opportunities for the kids and how we're going to do that, as well as perhaps provide a slightly greater financial savings. And so we'll be meeting tomorrow night in our next meeting to discuss where we go from here.
And Alice Worth, just briefly, if this goes forward, we're looking at the 2016-2017 school year that the consolidation could happen?
Yes.
Well, I appreciate both of you being here, opening up your discussions as we talk about this issue on a statewide basis. It's really been interesting to hear how these discussions are happening with you to look at this as a bigger issue. Alice Worth is superintendent of the Windsor Supervisory Union, Central Supervisory Union, and Greg Green is chair of the Pomfret Elementary School Board and a member of the Joint Elementary Study Committee. Greg, Alice, thank you both very much.
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you very much.
That will wrap up today's show. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about saving Vermont's barns. It's believed there are as many as 10,000 historic barns and farm buildings in the state, some dating back as far as the late 1700s. And some of them are still in daily use, but time and weather have taken a toll. We'll hear what assistance is available for barn owners and what efforts are underway to save these structures in the state. Send your questions or comments or photos about saving Vermont's barns to vermontedition@vpr.net. And listen tomorrow at noon. Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing are our producers. We have production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Peter Biello directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.